How do you feel when you switch to Geico and save on your car insurance? It's like going to work on one Thursday morning and thinking to yourself, just one more day until Friday. But then somebody in the elevator says, Happy Friday! Then you check your phone quickly and discover today is actually Friday. So yes, Happy Friday, random stranger in the elevator. Happy Friday indeed. Yep, switching and saving with Geico feels just like that. Get more with Geico.
There are a few instances, some more well-known than others, of people seemingly having foreknowledge of the JFK assassination, meaning that they knew that President Kennedy would be killed before it happened. As we look at these cases, the big questions are whether the alleged foreknowledge was specific and whether the claims by the person having that information are credible. One recently declassified document hinted at such foreknowledge. It was a letter from CIA counterintelligence chief James Angleton to FBI director J. Edgar Hoover. This memo says that an anonymous caller to a Cambridge, England newspaper said that the reporter should, quote, call the American embassy in London for some big news. The caller then hung up. What's notable about this call is that it was 25 minutes before President Kennedy was killed in Dallas. And while the call wasn't specifically about President Kennedy, the timing of it was close enough to make that inference. In this episode, we look at six more instances of reported foreknowledge of the murder of President Kennedy. We'll look at statements from Joseph Miltier, Eugene Dinkin, David Christensen, William Walter, Rose Shiremi, and Richard Case Nagel.
In Dallas, Texas, three shots were fired at President Kennedy's motorcade in downtown Dallas. The first reports say that President Kennedy has been seriously wounded by this shooting.
The flash, apparently official, President Kennedy died at 1 p.m. Central Standard Time.
This is Solving JFK. I'm your host, Matt Crumpton. First, there's the infamous tape recording of racist right-winger Joseph Miltier. On November 9th, 1963, Miltier, the leader of the state's rights party, was secretly recorded in Miami by police informant William Somerset talking about how President Kennedy's assassination was, quote, in the works. And he was specific. Here's some of the tape.
I don't know. Kennedy's coming here, I think, on the 18th or something like that, to make some kind of speech. I think it's the 18th he's supposed to be here to make a speech. And I don't even know what it's about.
If you can bet your bottom dollar, you're going to have a lot to say about the given, because there's so many of them here.
Why in the hell are you going to be the best way we'll be here?
From an office building.
If you couldn't understand the audio there, Somerset asked Miltier what was the best way to kill Kennedy, and Miltier responded, quote, from an office building with a high-powered rifle. Much of the tape is hard to understand, so it's easier to just read the highlights in the transcript. Somerset, I don't know how them Secret Service agents cover all of them office buildings everywhere he's going. Do you know whether they do that or not? Miltier. Well, if they have suspicion, they do. Of course, but without suspicion, chances are they wouldn't. Miltier later said, quote, hell, they'll pick up somebody within hours after, if anything like that would happen, just to throw the public off. According to the Secret Service, the unapologetically racist Miltier wasn't just some talker. He had ties to the people who blew up a black church in Birmingham, Alabama in September of 1963, tragically killing four young girls. The Miami Secret Service sent a copy of this Miltier tape to Robert Bauck, the head of the Protective Research Section of the Secret Service. Bauck then asked the Miami field office to look into it. This resulted in reports going out to five Secret Service field offices, but the report about this tape, where Miltier discusses killing President Kennedy from an office building with a high-powered rifle, never actually made its way to the people who planned the motorcade in Dallas because it was never sent to the Dallas Secret Service office. The next instance of potential foreknowledge is from Eugene B. Dinkin. U.S. Army Private First Class Dinkin was serving in Metz, France, when he went AWOL on November 4, 1963. Dinkin had been studying what he called psychological sets, which is basically the macro picture of media. He believed that he could determine messages being sent by studying the consistency and the type of stories being run. Dinkin said that by studying these psychological sets, he was able to determine that, quote, a conspiracy was in the making by the military of the United States, perhaps combined with an ultra-right economic group. Dinkin believed that Kennedy would be assassinated on November 28th by, quote, a communist or a Negro. On October 25th, Dinkin traveled to the U.S. Embassy in Luxembourg. He tried to relay his message to the embassy officials there about an impending assassination attempt on President Kennedy, but the Luxembourg U.S. Embassy officials refused to meet with Dinkin. When he got back to his army base in France, Dinkin was told that he would undergo a psychological evaluation on November 5th. This led Dinkin to go AWOL and head to Geneva, Switzerland, in an attempt to get the word out. On November 6th and 7th, Dinkin appeared in the press room of the United Nations in Geneva and spoke to reporters from all over the world, warning them about an impending attempt on President Kennedy's life. According to Geneva journalist Alex Desfontaine, one of the things that Dinkin said to reporters before the assassination was that, quote, they were plotting against President Kennedy and that something would happen in Texas. Dinkin later rejoined his unit in France on November 11th. He was then transferred to Walter Reed Hospital for several months after a diagnosis of schizophrenia. Dinkin was eventually discharged from the army and let out of the hospital. Incidentally, Vice President Lyndon Johnson visited Luxembourg on November 4th, about a week after Dinkin tried to alert the U.S. Embassy there about what he had learned. Some Warren Report critics believe that Johnson's travel to Luxembourg was in response to Dinkin's attempted meeting with the embassy officials there. But I wasn't able to find any documentary evidence that would substantiate that claim. Eugene Dinkin wasn't the only one in the armed forces who claimed to know about the assassination of President Kennedy in advance. In October of 1963, David Christensen worked for the Air Force Security Service in Kirknewton, Scotland. His job was to monitor and intercept intelligence communications traffic, which was then sent to his supervisors and ultimately to the National Security Agency in Fort Meade, Maryland. 15 years after President Kennedy was killed, Christensen claimed that he intercepted a communication from Lisbon, Portugal to Tangier, Morocco that was related to Kennedy's assassination. He wrote this claim in a letter that he sent to his former Air Force Security Service colleague in Scotland, Nicholas Stevenson. The letter said, quote, "You remember about a month or 6 weeks before I left Scotland when I picked up a link mentioning the assassination of President Kennedy? How hard I tried to get it sent out. And because of that effing Forney and DeLauder, they wouldn't send it to NSA. Since I have learned that the man's name most mentioned was number 4 in a certain branch of organized crime at the time. The House Select Committee on Assassinations learned about this letter and asked Nicholas Stevenson about it. Stevenson said that he did not recall the part that Christensen included about the JFK assassination, but everything else that Christensen said in the letter was accurate, according to Stevenson. He also confirmed that the communication that Christensen mentioned having picked up from Portugal to Morocco was one that they were able to hear at Kirk Newton. But Stevenson also said that if Christensen did intercept this transmission, he thought it would have been more widely known at the base among his peers. After receiving a request from the HSCA, the NSA looked through its files and said that they had nothing responsive when it came to David Christensen. But even if Christensen was telling the truth, there wouldn't have been any documents found in the NSA search. That's because the type of intercepts that Christensen alleges he heard were not sent to long-term storage anyway. Also, only 3 boxes of materials were ever reviewed by the NSA in their search for information about David Christensen. Although those boxes were marked 1963, the oldest document in any of the 3 boxes was from 1962. Christensen's story is interesting, but given that there is no independent corroboration of it, that Christensen was an alcoholic at the time, and that he waited 15 years to come forward by writing a letter to someone he used to serve with, it's fair to retain some healthy skepticism about his claims. The 4th potential instance of foreknowledge involves New Orleans FBI night clerk William S. Walter. Walter had the duty of handling incoming and outgoing communications during the overnight shift and notifying supervisors if action was necessary. Here's William Walter in front of the HSCA talking about a communication that he received on November 17, 1963, the Sunday before the assassination.
Sunday, I was again the only employee on duty, received a conference teletype originating from Washington and directed as conference to all SACs, meaning all special agent charges of all offices. At this particular teletype, as I recall, came into the New Orleans office, was received at the same time by the Memphis office, Dallas office, Mobile office, and the teletype was directed to our offices sort of as a movement teletype, indicating that President Kennedy was going to be traveling to Dallas, and that the information had been received somewhere within the Bureau that there would be possibly an attempt to assassinate him. Sometime during the trip to Dallas, the teletype requested that all field officers that received that teletype to contact informants of one nature or another to determine if any additional information could be developed as to the basis for such a threat being made.
Walter then said that the teletype had gone missing. The HSCA did not believe Walter's story because there were no teletypes found at any other places where Walter said they had also been sent. The HSCA was not able to find any corroborating information for this teletype. Either William Walter was making it up, or everyone else at the other FBI offices destroyed the teletypes and forgot about them.
How do you feel when you switch to GEICO and save on your car insurance? It's like going to work on one Thursday morning and thinking to yourself, just one more day until Friday. But then somebody in the elevator says, Happy Friday! Then you check your phone quickly and discover today's actually Friday. So yes, Happy Friday, random stranger in the elevator. Happy Friday indeed. Yep, switching and saving with GEICO feels just like that. Get more with GEICO.
In the late evening hours of Tuesday, November 19th, 1963, just days before President Kennedy would be assassinated, a woman got into an argument with two men at a roadside bar in Eunice, Louisiana, called the Silver Slipper Lounge. After the men left her at the bar, the woman, who was later identified as Rose Sheremy, began to hitchhike down the highway, but was struck by a car not far from the Silver Slipper. After being rushed to the hospital by the man who hit her, Sheremy was found to have no major injuries. But the hospital called Lieutenant Francis Frugier of the Louisiana State Police because Sheremy was clearly on drugs. After Frugier brought Sheremy to the jail, she freaked out and took all of her clothes off in the cell, which led to Frugier taking Sheremy in an ambulance to the East Louisiana State Hospital, the same mental institution in Jackson where Oswald had apparently applied for a job. After being sedated by a doctor, Sheremy was able to speak to Frugier, even though she was going through heroin withdrawals at the time. The two-hour car ride from Eunice to Jackson was in the early morning hours of Thursday, November 21st. During that trip, Frugier says that Sheremy told him, quote, "We're going to kill President Kennedy in a few days." She also talked about traveling with two guys, but Frugier did not take her seriously because she was sedated and she was acting wildly. On the Monday after the assassination, Frugier returned to the hospital to visit Sheremy and follow up about what she had said. Here's what Frugier said Sheremy told him when he spoke to the HSCA. Quote, "She was coming from Miami with two men who were either Cubans or Italians, and she was going to Dallas, then Houston. The men were going to kill Kennedy, and she was going to check in to the Rice Hotel, where reservations were already made for her, and pick up 10 kilos of heroin from a seaman who was coming into Galveston." Frugier forgot the seaman's name, but he said that customs should have it. "She was to pick up the money for the dope from a man who was holding her baby. She would then take the dope to Mexico." After hearing her story, Frugier relayed the information to Colonel Morgan of the state police, as well as the head of the state police, Colonel Burbank. Burbank told Frugier to look into Sheremy's story. Then, Frugier contacted Nathan Durham, the chief customs agent in Port Arthur, Texas. Durham called back 30 minutes later and confirmed that there was a ship that was coming into Galveston under the same name that Sheremy had said. And on that ship, there was a seaman matching the name of Sheremy's contact. U.S. Customs checked the Rice Hotel, and there was a reservation for Sheremy, just like she said there would be. And the man who allegedly had the money and Sheremy's baby was also checked into the hotel. Sheremy, Colonel Morgan, Frugier, and a state police pilot then flew to Houston in an effort to arrest the seaman with the dope. The operation to get the drugs was ultimately thwarted when the seaman was able to lose the customs agent who was following him. It isn't clear what happened to Sheremy's baby, assuming there was a baby. Frugier said that he saw baby clothes and shoes in one of the boxes that Sheremy was carrying with her. Frugier's claim about Sheremy's foreknowledge is somewhat supported by Dr. Victor Weiss from East Hospital. Dr. Weiss confirmed to Garrison investigators that he had treated Sheremy and that she said President Kennedy would be killed in Dallas. Dr. Weiss said that Cherami didn't know about a specific plot, but that, quote, word in the underworld was that Kennedy would be assassinated. Dr. Weiss's friend, A.H. Magruder, went on a hunting trip with Weiss in late December of 1963. On that hunting trip, Dr. Weiss confirmed to Magruder that Cherami had told him that Kennedy would be killed before the assassination. But Dr. Weiss did not remember in 1967, when speaking with Garrison investigators, whether Cherami made that statement before or after President Kennedy was killed, which is kind of the whole point. In addition to Lieutenant Frugier and Dr. Weiss, the story of Rose Cherami's foreknowledge of the assassination was confirmed by Louisiana State Police Officer Don White. Dr. Wayne Owen, who at the time was an intern at the hospital, later told the Madison Capital Times that he and other interns were told about the plot to kill President Kennedy in advance of the assassination. When asked by the HSCA, U.S. Customs did not deny Frugier's story, but the agents were not able to locate any of the documents that were related to the attempt to thwart the drug deal using Cherami's information. All of the agents who were working at the time no longer worked for U.S. Customs. It's clear that Frugier's 1978 testimony to the HSCA is central to whether or not Cherami actually had foreknowledge. Warren Report defenders argue that Frugier's HSCA testimony should be disregarded because he failed to raise the issue in two documents that were connected with Jim Garrison's 1967 investigation. In a March 13, 1967 memo from investigator Frank Maloche to Garrison, Maloche doesn't say anything about Frugier's foreknowledge of the assassination through Cherami. But that error could easily be on the part of the memo drafter Maloche, since a lot of information was being conveyed, including that Ruby and Oswald knew one another, that Cherami had seen them in a club together, and that Ruby and Oswald were, quote, bed partners. Ultimately, if Frugier heard from Cherami about the assassination in advance, we would expect that information to be included in this memo. In an April 4th, 1967 memo from Frugier to Garrison, Frugier fails to address the point of Cherami's alleged foreknowledge, but he does say, quote, other statements made by subject relative to your inquiry are hearsay but are available upon your request. This disclaimer about hearsay at the end of the memo does seem to potentially address Frugier not including Cherami's sensational statement. This memo mostly deals with the details of how and when Cherami died, so we wouldn't necessarily expect to hear much about the other information in this memo. But on the other hand, Frugier did include this tidbit, quote, Cherami was in custody from November 21st, 1963 through November 28th, 1963, and that she once worked for Jack Ruby as a stripper, which was verified, and that Ruby and Lee Harvey Oswald were definitely associated and known to be, as she stated, bed partners. She further referred to Ruby as alias Pinky. There are also potential issues with Dr. Weiss's support of Frugier's story. As mentioned earlier, Dr. Weiss told Jim Garrison's investigators that he wasn't sure if the Cherami statement was before or after the assassination. And probably the most damning thing to Dr. Weiss's credibility is that he claimed to the HSCA that he first met Cherami on November 25th through Dr. Bowers, who relayed the story about Cherami having the assassination foreknowledge. But Dr. Bowers has expressly denied the story and says that he never even treated Rose Cherami. Warren Report critic James D. Eugenio claims that Dr. Weiss was lying about Dr. Bowers telling him about Cherami because Dr. Weiss was scared and he didn't want to be involved in the case. It's also true that with Cherami's background and rap sheet, she was not generally a credible witness. In 1957, she was charged with providing false information to police in the murder of a man named Franklin Doan. In 1960, after being arrested for public intoxication and attacking a police officer, she took her clothes off in the cell and set them on fire, which led to an arson charge. Without a doubt, this lady was not generally reliable and had a lifelong struggle with drugs and alcohol. But everyone knew that already. The fact that her seemingly ridiculous prediction about JFK's assassination actually happened is the only reason that anyone ever listened to her. The Rose Cherami story is a tough one. I can't think of a reason why Frugier, Officer White, Dr. Weiss, and Dr. Owen would all lie. These are professionals without a known track record of lying. What would these people have to gain from teaming up to lie about Rose Cherami? On the other hand, the stakes are high, and the written record supporting the claims of Frugier and Dr. Weiss are inconsistent at best. A December 1963 FBI report may be able to shed some light on the Rose Cherami saga. About a week after the assassination, on November 28th, Margaret K. Kaufman from Martinsburg, Pennsylvania, contacted the FBI about a piece of newspaper that was found by her mother. It was a ripped-out advertisement for a trailer. On the newspaper ad, there were handwritten notes. The top middle of the page had the name Lee Oswald. The top right said Rubenstein. In the middle of the page, Jack Ruby was written with Dallas, Texas written under that. And here's what ties this back to Cherami. On the top left corner of the page, there was the name of a club. According to Kaufman, it was either the Silver Bell or the Silver Slipper, which is the name of the lounge where Cherami was abandoned by the two men that she had been traveling with. Kaufman's mother, Margaret Hoover, also corroborated the story about the newspaper, but she did not recall the name of the club. It turns out that Hoover was renting a house to Dr. Julio Cesar Fernandez, a Cuban refugee who had been teaching at the local junior high school. Dr. Fernandez would regularly burn trash in the backyard, which was immediately below the apartment where Hoover was living. Hoover found this newspaper trailer ad with the handwriting on it under her porch. And oh, by the way, Dr. Fernandez's brother-in-law, Antonio Ferraz, had been the chief of police under Fulgencio Batista in Cuba before the Castro Revolution. But Kaufman's husband told the FBI that his wife was influenced by her mother, Margaret Hoover, and was probably just going along with this story to make her mom happy. The biggest argument against Hoover's claim is that she did not have the physical copy of the newspaper at the time she contacted the FBI. The allegation by Warren Report defenders is that Kaufman and her mom participated in a hoax and made up this story after Oswald and Ruby were already household names. But there's no possible way that Kaufman could have known about Rose Cherami and the Silver Slipper at the time that she spoke to the FBI. Of course, the Silver Slipper was just the place where these two guys left Rose Cherami. It's not central to the assassination. And coincidences are possible. This would be a big one. Finally, we come to the story of Richard Case Nagel, who was either one of the most important witnesses to the backstory of the JFK assassination Or he was a truly crazy guy who somehow got his hands on some items that are hard to explain. The Mary Farrell Foundation page that's dedicated to Nigel has links to the related primary documents and does a good job of summarizing the basics. It says, quote, "On September 20th, 1963, Richard Case Nigel walked into a bank in El Paso, Texas. He fired two shots into the wall near the ceiling, walked back out to his car, and waited to be arrested. Subsequently, Nigel would claim that he was a double or triple agent of the United States and the KGB, that he knew Lee Harvey Oswald and was monitoring the JFK assassination plot, which involved Cuban exiles, and that he had been ordered to kill Oswald to prevent the plot from being carried out. He also maintained that he had sent a registered letter to FBI Director Hoover warning him of the plot. Nigel said that he shot into the wall at the bank so that he would be arrested and not have to go through with killing Oswald or being killed because he refused to. Nigel's story, if he's telling the truth, is extremely rich and complex. What's being covered here is just the tip of the iceberg, and we may revisit Nigel again in season 3. But for now, we need to find out if his account of foreknowledge is credible. There are some reasons to have healthy skepticism of Nigel's story. He was in two plane crashes where everyone else on board the planes died, but Nigel survived both of them because of his parachuting skills that he learned in the Army. In the second crash, which was in November of 1954, he suffered serious head injuries. Nigel's behavior became erratic after his head injury. There are several instances where different medical professionals are on the record saying that Nigel was mentally ill and should be hospitalized. After his wife filed for divorce in 1958, Nigel claimed that she had shot him in the chest, but the doctor who treated him said that Nigel's gunshot wound was self-inflicted. A June 1968 CIA document says that Nigel's mother, brother, ex-wife, and friend all, quote, considered him to be mentally disturbed. Also, Nigel flat out said in a court filing to appeal his bank robbery conviction, quote, "My whole purpose in entering the bank in El Paso was for the purpose of obtaining psychiatric help and treatment, and not for the purpose of actually robbing the bank." Of course, Nigel was trying to get out of jail at the time, so he may have just been saying what he thought he needed to say. When I was researching Richard Case Nigel's story, my immediate thought was to look for the first statement that he made that specifically mentioned the JFK assassination. But the lack of any specific statements in the record before November 22nd does not bode well for Nigel's credibility. His court-appointed attorney, Fred Morton, said that Nigel never mentioned anything about the assassination to him, and that he didn't learn about that claim until years later. On the other hand, Nigel was cryptic about his reasons for shooting into the wall at the El Paso Bank. Before the assassination, he told a U.S. district court, quote, "I had a motive for doing what I did, but my motive was not to hold up the bank. I do not intend to disclose my motive at this time." We just laid out a lot of good reasons to discount Nigel's story. Basically, he's crazy, and he didn't make any specific warnings about the assassination that we have a record for today. But the problem with just writing off Nigel is that there is some evidence that he was credible. Specifically, Nigel had the names of active intelligence assets written in his notebook when he was arrested. The director of security for the CIA wrote to the FBI on April 7th, 1964, listing these names and then telling the FBI, quote, "It would be appreciated if your bureau would advise this agency of any information brought to your attention concerning how the above names came into possession of Nagel." Additionally, Nagel's notebook had the same unlisted phone number for the Cuban embassy in Mexico City that Oswald had in his notebook. Nagel also verified that a CIA agent in Mexico City was undercover, as established by another CIA agent. And perhaps most notably, when Nagel was arrested at the bank, he had a near duplicate of Oswald's Uniform Services Identification and Privileges card. But the card Nagel had said Alex J. Hiddell with Oswald's photo. This document is not available in the Warren Commission volumes, but it is in the photo section of Dick Russell's book about Richard Case Nagel. When the Assassination Records Review Board was convened in the 1990s, they sent Nagel a letter asking to interview him. The ARRB was then informed that Nagel had died the day after the letter was sent to him by the ARRB. The coroner said that he died of a heart attack. According to Nagel biographer Dick Russell, Nagel told his niece about a purple trunk that he had with key evidence about the JFK assassination. After Nagel's death, his son Robert found the address of a Tucson, Arizona storage unit and traveled there to retrieve the contents. Robert Nagel arrived to the storage unit to find that the purple trunk was missing. And when Robert returned home to California, his house had been broken into and ransacked. Robert told researcher Richard Booth via email in late 1997 or early 1998 that immediately after his father died, a man and a woman who said that they were with the State Department came to his house and asked to look in his dad's study. The man and the woman said that they were there to investigate North Korean counterfeit notes. When it comes to Richard Case Nagel, we have to come to terms with two things being true at the same time. Nagel was mentally unstable, and he was not a reliable witness. But Nagel wasn't just some random crazy person. Given the evidence that we just discussed, he very well may have been what he says he was, a CIA asset. But the challenge is finding out what things Nagel said were true and what things were made up. I wish I had a definitive answer for that, but I don't. Next time on Solving JFK, we come back to Mexico City for a recap and rebuttals episode, and we hear from Dr. John Newman on the subject. After that, we'll have another recap and rebuttals for episodes 56 through 59 before wrapping up season 2 with the conclusion episode. If you heard anything that you believe is out of context, or if you have additional information to offer, you can let us know at solvingjfkpodcast@gmail.com. Please provide citations to the record for any fact that you're relying on. For transcripts, sources, and official podcast merchandise, visit solvingjfkpodcast.com.
In Dallas, Texas, three shots were fired at President Kennedy's motorcade in downtown Dallas.
The flash, apparently official, President Kennedy died at 1 p.m. Central Standard Time.
Thanks for listening. Visit solvingjfkpodcast.com for more information.
How do you feel when you switch to GEICO and save on your car insurance? It's like going to work on one Thursday morning and thinking to yourself, just one more day until Friday. But then somebody in the elevator says, "Happy Friday!" Then you check your phone quickly and discover today is actually Friday. So yes, happy Friday, random stranger in the elevator. Happy Friday indeed. Yep, switching and saving with GEICO feels just like that. Get more with GEICO.